The second case for oral argument this morning is State Auto Insurance Company's appellant versus, Audrey Alt would be the appellate. For the appellant, State Auto Insurance Company, we have Mr. Mitchell Peterson, attorney from Sioux Falls. And for the appellate Alt, we have Mark Arndt, an attorney also from Sioux Falls. Mr. Peterson, you may proceed, sir, and you have 20 minutes.
May it please the court. This case involves a number of legal issues, but largely there's one overriding question that is of the most policy importance today. And that is, who should bear the risk of loss when a minor child maliciously and willfully causes damages through the operation of a motor vehicle? Should it be that child's parent, or should it be the victim of the tort? In answering that question, our common law provides answers. Our statute, South Dakota Statute 25-5-15, provides answers. And when the law is applied to the following material facts, I think the court will be left with a clear decision in this case.
The minor is responsible for her own torts, isn't she?
Absolutely, Your Honor.
All right. So you could pursue for obtaining a judgment against her.
In fact, this suit also involves a suit against the minor child. The litigation has been stayed pending this appeal just to determine what action will be taken following this appeal. So there certainly is a minor that's responsible, but as the court can well imagine, there are few and far minors that actually have the ability to pay a judgment.
You don't have to prove up any malicious conduct on her part. Just simply straight negligence is enough, isn't it?
Against the daughter, yes. I mean, the daughter in this case, the legal issues are very clear. It's a clear liability situation. The issue is there's another party that is also responsible that would probably be in a much better position to pay a judgment than a minor would be, which is why they're both defendants were pursued in this case.
What do the statutes say about a minor in regard to the motor vehicle? Is there a age limit that they become liable, or is it just whenever they get a license? Does it say, or is it silent?
I believe it's silent on that issue. I believe the common law is, regardless of the age of the child, they're responsible for their own negligence, intentional acts. I think that's pretty clear. Obviously, the statute in this case deals with what responsibility the parent has when you have an intentional, actually not intentional, malicious or willful act of the child. William Close in this case owned a 2001 Suburban. He was out of town on a particular day, and the defendant, an appellee, Audrey Alt, went to his house to water some plants. When she left, she forgot to lock the back patio door. Later that same day, her daughter and the Close's granddaughter came to go swimming with a friend. She later decided that she wanted to go pick up a friend in town. She entered through the house through that unlocked back patio door, which would otherwise have been locked but for the actions of the defendant, Audrey Alden, in this case. She took the vehicle without permission. She did not have a license. She had almost no experience driving. The only experience she had was gained through driving without a license with the defendant, Audrey Alt, which happened on at least one prior occasion, according to the evidence in the record submitted by State Auto.
What's malicious about that? You just described the facts, and I didn't hear anything that was malicious about that.
I believe the malicious and willful act would be the theft of a motor vehicle. She had no permission to take it. I believe it would qualify as a criminal act. Certainly it qualifies as a conversion, a civil theft. I believe it would be a malicious and willful act to take somebody else's property without their permission. I think that would qualify under the language of 25-5.
But is there any evidence that she deliberately drove the car in such a way as to wreck it?
No, Your Honor. There's no evidence that the daughter tried to roll the vehicle or tried to damage the vehicle. But it was certainly through her malicious and willful acts of stealing that vehicle, in the course of that theft of the vehicle, it was damaged. It's certainly a foreseeable consequence. When you steal a vehicle, you may damage it. While it may not be specifically foreseeable that she would roll the vehicle at a particular point on the road. I mean, nobody can foresee that, but that's not what the law requires. It requires a general foreseeability.
You keep using the word steal. I mean, there's no intent here to deprive the owner of permanent possession of this. In fact, she was on her way back when she rolled it, wasn't she? She was in the process of returning it to the location where she got it from?
Yes, Your Honor. She did not. There's no evidence in the record that she intended to permanently deprive Close of the vehicle. But the evidence is clear. She intended to deprive him of that vehicle for the time that it was gone and to use it without anybody's permission. And certainly if she had intended to steal it permanently, that's a whole other layer of malicious intent, but we don't have to go that far in order to meet the statutory requirements.
And this is just a summary judgment motion, right? So we have to take the facts in the light most favorable?
Yes, Your Honor. And then there are some disputed facts, but as Your Honor pointed out, the facts must be viewed from State Auto's position on this motion. The statute at issue, 25-5-15, was passed in 1957. Prior to that, under the common law and under the statute, which is now 25-5-14, which was passed in 1939, declared that parents are not responsible for their children's activities. That was pretty much a given. But in 1957, our legislature sat down with a purpose in mind that parents are going to have some liability. And that's when they crafted 25-5-15, with the purpose of providing some relief to tort victims and holding the parent responsible.
At that point, it was a lot lower number, wasn't it? $500 or something like that. It was much lower than the 15.
I believe that's correct, Your
Honor. And also, was the phrase here that's at issue, referring to motor vehicle, was that part of the 1957 adoption, or was that added later?
That was in the 1957 adoption, Your Honor. And the original version of the statute, I believe, is set forth in its entirety in the appellant's reply brief as it was originally passed. There's later another sentence that's added, and over time that the damage cap number has changed. Most recently it was amended to be $1,500. Essentially, there are two statutes, or two parts of the statute that are at issue. The first sentence provides that when someone suffers damage, whether it's property damage or personal injury, through the willful and malicious acts of the child, there will be a cause of action against the parent. There's an entirely separate second sentence that has two parts divided by a comma. So there are two clauses that we're dealing with in the second sentence. The first clause says the damages are capped at $1,500. Then it says, comma, and does not apply to damages proximately caused to the operation of a motor vehicle by the minor child. Ultimate question is, what doesn't apply? Liability in the first instance, or the sentence, or the part of the sentence immediately preceding that, the damage cap? I think a plain reading of the statute makes clear that what it's referring to is a subject matter immediately preceding it. And when we apply the doctrine of the last antecedent, which this court has done on several occasions, when you've got some sort of modifying language, whether it's a sentence by itself or a clause within a sentence, unless there is something that is obvious in the statute, that applies only to the immediate antecedent clause or sentence.
Let me just interrupt you on that sentence. Being an old English teacher, going back here, and if you were to analyze this sentence, the second sentence that you're referring to, it would appear to me that the subject of that sentence is amount of recovery, and the verb of that subject is shall be limited and does not apply. Because and, when you really look at this, connects the two verbs in that sentence. Now, why they put the comma in there, I don't know, but if you use and, it's a conjunction that usually connects two equal clauses. So the only thing I can see that's equal here is the shall be limited and does not apply. Does that change your analysis of this? So then it would say, if I'm eliminating the extra words, in this case, the amount of recovery shall be limited to $1,500 and does not apply to damages caused by a motor vehicle.
Well,
so if that's the correct analysis of this sentence, and that it actually, the second clause that you refer to, I don't think the antecedent analysis applies. I think it's the verb of that sentence. If that's the case, how would you interpret that then? What does that mean?
Well, Your Honor raised an interesting point, and I too am an English major, and the comma is particularly troubling. Without the comma there, I think the analysis that you explained to us, Meyer Henry, makes sense. The comma there means something, though. It's not a stray comma. It divides two separate ideas.
Well, and then going back, though, the only reason I could see the comma is because prior to that, there is another and. And in order to, it says, actual damages of $1,500 and the taxable costs. And in order to make sure that the next and isn't part of that series, they've put a comma. That was my only explanation. But I don't know whether that changes the analysis or the meaning. Even if you say that this is part of a verb, I'm not sure that changes the meaning.
Well, I think what we have to think about is, what was the legislature trying to do? Why are motor vehicles special? Why are they being called apart and set apart differently from all the other ways that children can intentionally and maliciously and willfully damage property? I think when you look at this, there's a lot of things that kids do. They can vandalize property, spray paint things. Kids do all sorts of crazy things. And those are more in the nature of a prank. When you're dealing with motor vehicles, that's where serious injuries happen. And the point of the statute is to provide compensation to people who need it.
Following up on that, here's what concerns me. If you have a 16-year-old, you know they drive, so you put them on your insurance policy. If they do what this gal did and they're 16, you get insurance coverage. But here, because she's 14, I doubt anybody would put a 14-year-old on your parents and car insurance policy if the company even let you. So all of a sudden the parent's getting a nasty surprise that your 14-year-old has now basically subjected you to unlimited liability and you have no insurance coverage. Doesn't that fly in the face of our legislative policy of promoting car insurance coverage for everybody who drives a car?
That's an interesting point, Your Honor, and I don't think there's a way that you could get the daughter on a liability policy, an auto liability policy. I think what's important to look at is there's actually a 1955 case in California from the Supreme Court. I don't know if our court had or our legislature had that in mind. It's the Arneson case that was cited in the brief. And what that states is that when you've gotten vicarious liability for a parent, simply because they're a parent, they're liable, that there is homeowners coverage for that. Regardless if a motor vehicle is involved or whatever the mechanism of the injury or the damage is.
But would it cover willful and malicious and willful?
Not for the child, but for the parent it does, because that's not part of the cause of action. The parent is liable simply because they're a parent. It has nothing to do with the intent. It's a strict liability statute. And the California case, and there's a host of other cases cited in the appellant's briefs, that talk about homeowners coverage, providing coverage to the parent for vicarious liability.
Why would they have limited it to $1,500, everything but automobiles, motor vehicles? Why would they limit the $1,500 and not limit the motor vehicles damages?
I think it's because setting apart motor vehicles, I think the garden variety, malicious, willful act of a child is going to be in the nature of a prank. A jury could run wild and get absolutely ridiculous, and the legislature wants to cap that. But when we have a dangerous instrument like a motor vehicle, that's when people get killed, it's when people get seriously hurt, and that's where people really need the compensation. I think that's why it was set aside. Coupled with the fact it was passed in 1957, and the Supreme Court case in California in 1955, and California is often a law that we look to, that very well may be coincidental, but the fact is, the majority of the states provide homeowners coverage to the parent for vicarious liability. So there's going to be essentially a deep pocket or actual compensation to go after from the parent's standpoint. They can guard against the children's behavior by simply taking out a homeowners policy.
What does this last sentence mean in that? I know you didn't get into that, but it's a curiosity to me, this last sentence that requires, if the parent is not responsible for the full amount of actual damages and costs, it shall be justified in specific finding in writing or on the record. What is that talking about? I don't understand that part of it.
Your Honor, that makes two of us. I'm not sure what that's referring to. I don't know if that's a situation where you've got punitive damages and then compensatory actual damages, that those things need to be separated, because the first part of the statute, it talks about the damages that are actually suffered, where punitive damages arguably wouldn't be suffered. So maybe that the division needs to be set out by the court. That's really the only thing I can come up with.
So if you prevail, you're going to have to figure out how to instruct the jury on this one.
That would be a tangle for the trial court, Your Honor. I'd be remiss if I didn't touch on some of the other issues. The vicarious liability question is one issue, but there are direct independent liability issues in this case. Audrey Elt left the door unlocked. The case law cited by the appellant in this case shows that when you do something that is negligent, that facilitates or enables property damage or a theft to take place, there is at least a jury question as to whether you're, as the negligent actor, are liable.
Since this 14-year-old had never done this before, where is the foreseeability that you leaving the door unlocked is going to result in your child taking the car?
There isn't that foreseeability, and that level of specificity is not required. It is in the general risk, if you leave a door unlocked that is otherwise locked, someone may break in. That it was Adriel's daughter is really not a material issue as to foreseeability.
Do you have one case that talks about leaving a door unlocked, or that you have a duty of care to lock a door, other than if you're a bailment situation or a landlord-tenant situation? The only cases I could find dealt with those kinds of issues, not a private premises. I mean, it's usually there's a duty from either the bailment or like a landlord requiring to have an outside door lock so that for safety reasons. Do you have one case that's on point here?
Not on the specific facts, but under the Kuehl versus Horner Lumber case, it talks about the duty arises from two things. One is foreseeability of an action, and the second one is a sufficient relationship. In this case, Adriel was given a key and had access to closest home because of their special relationship. And out of that relationship is where the negligence arises, the failure to lock a door. And that is how Dugan got into the house, is through the back door.
Well, you know, my house is 125 years old. When I bought it 10 years ago, it had no locks on the door. It never had had locks on the door. There's all kinds of people in this state that don't lock their houses. Are we then, by adopting your argument, ruling that if they don't install locks, they're somehow liable because somebody comes into their house and steals a gun or a knife or what have you? Are we?
Well, I think we're at a preliminary issue of, is there a duty? Is there even a duty to do that? It's, I think, up to a jury to determine, you know, would this have happened anyway? Was that the proximate cause of why the property is stolen? But that involves factual issues that the jury needs to sort out in this case.
So you're going to get sued if you don't have locks on your doors, whether you win or lose the lawsuit, if somebody steals something out of your house?
Absolutely not, Your Honor. The issue in this case is the closest otherwise had their house locked. They gave unique access to that to Alt, who failed to lock the door.
But it's not very much of a stretch then to take that to the people that don't have locks on their doors or don't lock them routinely. It doesn't matter. Custom or whatever.
I'm not sure I understand quite the point. If you're
suggesting that there's liability here because Mrs. Ault did not lock the door of her parents' home, and because of that the car was stolen, damages were incurred, what is the difference from people that routinely don't lock their house or don't even have locks on their doors, and thus allow thieves, kids, whoever happens to wander in the door to come in, take a gun, knife, or what have you, car? Are we now changing the standard of care in South Dakota for everybody, saying you will have locks on your doors and you will lock them or you will be sued?
I think the issues are different. It's one case where I decide not to lock my door, a thief breaks in, takes a gun, and causes a crime. That's a different case than if I lock my door, I allow someone a key to have access, and then that person doesn't lock the door, and they damage my property.
She found the door locked went in and left it unlocked. Is that, that's the facts as they stand now?
That would be the facts in the record, Your Honor. So I think the example given by Your Honor Justice Gilbertson is, I think it's different. I think that line's pretty easily drawn, that when I allow someone access to my home and they don't lock my door and my property is damaged, I think I should have a cause of action against that person for leaving my door unlocked if my property is otherwise locked.
So for the present time, you may be over the problem of duty, but then with a jury, you'd have the problem of foreseeability and proximate cause and damages, of course, resulting from all of those things.
That's correct, Your Honor. I think that involves a clear dispute of fact. Certainly this is far from a slam dunk as we get over the duty issue, but I think it is a case that a jury needs to wrestle with and make some decisions.
Thank you. Your time has expired. Okay, Mr. Arndt, you have 20 minutes, sir.
Thank you, Mr. Chief Justice, members of the court and counsel. May it please the courts, I'm Mark Arndt of the law firm of Mann Johnson Sioux Falls on behalf of defendant and appellee Audrey Ault. Initially, I want to indicate to the court that I believe the standard of review on this appeal is de novo. Furthermore, the court has recently given some indications on summary judgment reviews in the Wolf decision in 2003 that the court on summary judgments, on ruling on summary judgment issues, determines only whether a genuine issue of material fact exists and whether the law was applied correctly. If there is a basis which supports the ruling of the trial court, then this court will affirm. I want to start regarding some of the factual issues that were raised by counsel for State Auto and indicate to the court, without going into a lot of detail regarding the specifics of the factual record in front of the court, that if the court has any questions about some of the facts that were developed, I think they were fully part of this record. The transcripts of both Audrey Ault and Brandy Dugan, the mother and daughter, are part of this record. They're cited at the clerk's certificate number 31. A lot of the facts in which State Auto relies upon to bring in disputed material facts, such as the leaving of the door open and other issues, are cited in an affidavit of a State Auto adjuster by the name of Karen Buckley. And her affidavit is available at the clerk's certificate 41. It's quite brief. Obviously, Ms. Buckley was not a party to these proceedings and wasn't present when they took place. And I think in order for the court to get a full feel of some of the important factual issues, if the court has any doubt about this case, that it should review both those transcripts and Ms. Buckley's affidavit. Specifically, this last issue that was addressed by a question from one of the justices indicated that it's settled that Ms. Ault left a door open to this home. Well, and I realize the facts must be taken in the light most favorable to State Auto. However, if you read the transcripts of Ms. Ault, she adamantly denies leaving the door open. Ms. Buckley's affidavit only states that a back patio door was left open. It doesn't state who left it open or any details regarding the identity of somebody leaving the door open. It only states that it was left open. Setting aside those facts, I'll start with my analysis of the statutes at issue, which are directly on point and we believe are dispositive of the claim against Ms. Ault. 25.514 sets forth the general rule that a parent and child are responsible for their own tortious acts. 25.515 sets forth the single exception that the court is obviously aware of, that for willful and malicious acts, the parent may be held liable up to $1,500. It goes on to state, under our reading, and we believe the plain reading, that parents are never liable for the results of their children as that arise from a motor vehicle accident. And we believe a plain reading supports that. We will certainly concede that the statute could have been written more clearly to establish that, but nonetheless, a plain reading of the statute, I think, establishes clearly that the legislature did not intend parents to be liable for their children's motor vehicle accidents.
However, that second clause or the second sentence refers to the amount of recovery. You say they're never liable. How do you get that out of that sentence?
Well, I think the amount of recovery, the $1,500 cap, Your Honor, if that's what you're referring to, applies to the willful and malicious acts of the child. Certainly, the legislature, in thinking about motor vehicle accidents, may not have considered that the willful and malicious acts of drivers, motor vehicle accidents, would be applicable to that. Most, I think, it's not a stretch to say most of the motor vehicle accidents that occur are going to occur as a result of negligence and not as a result of a willful and malicious act. So I think that is the distinction. Furthermore, I believe our position regarding the plain reading of 25.515 is supported by the statutory scheme in general. We have guidance from our legislature on this issue. We cited three statutes in particular that support the legislature's position on parental liability for minors driving automobiles. 26.14 states that a minor is civilly liable for their wrongs done like any other person. 26.11-1 states that minors are to be prosecuted as adults for traffic offenses. 26.8C-2 states that traffic offenses are outside of the definition of a delinquent child. So again, they're to be treated like adults in adult traffic court, if you will. All of those statutes are consistent with Ault's plain reading of 25.515. Furthermore, and I'm glad Justice Meyer Henry pointed this out, or at least asked the question, we believe if you look at the statute carefully, to say that the legislature's intent was to hold a parent liable for a child's willful and malicious acts up to a cap of $1,500, yet hold them unlimited liability for motor vehicle accidents is not logical. You know, we can easily think of situations in which a child can take a pellet gun and shoot out the windows of a home and create more damage than $1,500, or take a baseball bat to a car. But yet, in those situations, the parent is only going to be capped at $1,500. To say that the parent should be subject to unlimited liability for motor vehicle accidents, I don't believe is a logical conclusion to what the legislature's intent was when they drafted this statute. State Auto asked the court to apply some principles of statutory construction, including the doctrine of last antecedent. However, as we pointed out in Ault's brief, including the most recent decision by this court on this issue, State v. Johnson, in 2004, the court clearly said if the words and phrases in the statute have plain meaning and effect, we should simply declare their meaning and not resort to statutory construction. I don't believe that we need to go into doctrines of last antecedent or other methods of statutory construction when the meaning appears plain from your first reading of the statute, your first blush gut reaction to a reading of the statute, and especially when that reading is consistent with other statutory schemes set up by our legislature on this issue. The legislature has given us guidance as to how we want to treat minors when they get into motor vehicles, and we believe our reading of 25.515 is consistent with that guidance. Furthermore, it's not unthinkable to consider what the practical implications would be of 16-year-old daughters or boys driving motor vehicles and creating problems for parents. Certainly, if the court were to adopt State Auto's position on this issue, we can think of scenarios in which teenage drivers involved in motor vehicle accidents and anybody who believes they were wronged by that offense, not only would the plaintiff be suing the teenage driver, but of course the plaintiff would immediately be suing the parents as well, because it subjects them to liability. The issue of the driver's intent is going to be an issue of fact, and why wouldn't you, if you were the plaintiff, sue both the teenage driver and the parents of that offense? Even if you had to prove willfulness and maliciousness, what's the harm in suing both of them and letting the jury sort that out? That's one additional deep pocket that you could attack in your lawsuit, and all of a sudden we have parents involved in lawsuits for their teenagers driving. Whether they're under an auto policy or not under an auto policy, parents are going to be subject to multiple lawsuits if the court were to adopt State Auto's position on this issue. We believe 25.515 was certainly intended to clarify that by providing the parents with a blanket exception that parents are not responsible for their children's automobile accidents. We also would submit to the court that if the court adopts Ault's plain reading of 25.515, It is 100% dispositive of all of the issues that have been raised against Ault in this particular claim. I realize there are claims of vicarious liability brought by State Auto, and I'm happy to address those, but nonetheless, I think it's undisputed that this accident was caused by a minor child driving a motor vehicle, a single vehicle accident in which the minor rolled the vehicle and caused the damage to the vehicle. That's the cause, and if you adopt our reading of 25.515, Audrey Ault, as the mother of Brandy Dugan, is not responsible for her actions.
Is that what the trial court did?
The trial court actually ruled in favor of Audrey Ault on both the issue of 25.515, as well as holding that for the vicarious liability claims by State Auto, they did not meet their element of a duty. So the trial court actually granted the summary judgment on both bases. I believe that's attached to Ault's brief, the actual summary judgment order by Judge Cirska.
What did the trial court say about the willful and malicious conduct in stealing the vehicle and getting in an automobile accident?
Well, there weren't any, since this was summary judgment, there weren't any specific findings regarding that, Your Honor. However, I'm not, I guess, being present for the oral arguments and listening to the court's ruling, I'm not sure the court felt it was necessary to get to that level. I think the court agreed with our interpretation of 25.515 and said the legislature has created a blanket exception for parents as a result of children driving motor vehicles. And therefore, whether her intent was negligent or willful and malicious, in either case, 25.515 provided the mother, Audrey Ault, with an exception to liability. I will address the vicarious liability.
Let me ask you one thing, Bob. You know, the trial court made two rulings. The trial court talked about vicarious liability, but also talked about duty. And duty's not an issue under vicarious liability. So it seems to me that the trial court was talking about two legal concepts here.
I would agree with Your Honor, and I would believe, and again, I would state to the court that if there's a basis which supports the ruling, either of those bases could be enough to support the affirmance of Judge Cirska's summary judgment issue.
But that then means that the vicarious liability reading that you would have us make of the statute doesn't dispose of the whole case. There's a second issue about Ault's independent negligence.
Well, and that may be then, you know, if that's the court's interpretation that 25.515 isn't dispositive of the vicarious liability as well, or the separate liability, then we would have to delve into the issue of duty, which I'm happy to address, and certainly the trial court did that as well in issuing its ruling. The issue of duty in this case, and back up to some general parameters regarding duty in general, certainly the question of duty is a question of law. It is subject to de novo review. And it's also an essential element of any plaintiff's negligent claim. We cite in our brief the restatement of torts second for some authority on this issue. And I know this court has used the restatement in the past for guidance regarding common law torts. Section 315 of the restatement sets forth the general rule that third parties have no duty to control the conduct of others. Now, there are some exceptions to that rule. One of those exceptions would be parental liability. That's set forth in Section 316 of the restatement, and that basically sets forth two factors for parental liability and in order for a court to find that the parent has a duty to the plaintiff. And the two factors are, number one, the parent's knowledge of the child's propensity for causing the harm, and number two, the parent's ability to control the child. I would emphasize for the court that there is no factual basis, in our opinion, that would support a finding that Audrey Ault had knowledge that her child was going to commit this offense or anything like this offense, or that she had the ability to control her child from committing that offense. There's no pattern in which Brandy Dugan had been taking vehicles in the past and driving them without someone's authority. There's no pattern or even an incident in which Brandy Dugan had been going to her grandparents' home and using the facilities, car or otherwise, without someone's authority. So it is difficult, as from Audrey Alt's perspective, to say that she had the ability and the knowledge to control and stop what Randy Dugan would be doing on that day. The facts simply do not support that finding. Again, this is a legal issue in which the court must apply those two factors, the knowledge of the child's propensity for causing harm and the ability to control the child, and the court in this case simply found that there was no such duty based on the facts of this case.
What about the duty to lock the house?
Yeah, I'm glad you asked that, and I'm glad there were questions directed to opposing counsel on that issue. I would agree that the concept of leaving a door unlocked or a window unlocked or whatever the case may be, to hold somebody liable for that is quite the slippery slope. I understand what opposing counsel is saying about the facts of this case, the house at least arguably being locked and then later being unlocked, is their position as to why that would create some liability. But we can imagine the case in which anyone walks out of their home in the morning, leaves the door unlocked. Let's say it's a situation where the person 99 days out of 100 locks their door, but on this one particular day, for whatever reason, they're in a rush, have a crisis, forget to lock their door, and their home is later burglarized.
But they're relying on the relationship, because of the relationship here that she had the duty to lock it.
And I would also, I guess, address that specific question with Your Honor by saying I'm not aware of any authority, again, except, as Your Honor noted, maybe a bailment issue or bailment argument that may apply. I'm not aware of any other authority that would put a housekeeper or a house watcher or a relative that would create, leaving a door unlocked in that situation would create a duty upon that person. And I would also again emphasize for the court that I don't believe that even the facts in light most favorable to State Auto support that contention. Audrey Alt adamantly denied leaving any door unlocked. The only assertion there is to the contrary is Ms. Buckley's affidavit, which only states, Audrey Alt told me that Brandy Dugan entered the closest home through a back patio door, which was left open. It doesn't say Audrey Alt left it open. It doesn't say how that door may have been opened. Now, our contention is that's not how Dugan entered the house anyway, but I don't believe the facts, even in light most favorable to State Auto, shows that Audrey Alt left any door or window unlocked in the home on that day.
But is that even that relevant? I mean, the question of duty is based on foreseeability. And isn't it, I mean, completely foreseeable that if you're watching somebody else's house and don't lock the door, you might suffer a theft loss or a burglary, or there's a risk, a foreseeable risk of harm.
Well,
in watching somebody else's house and not locking their door.
I would agree with Your Honor that it's not unforeseeable, but in the context of establishing foreseeability through a legal duty, I don't believe that those facts would support finding a legal duty under these facts and circumstances. Simply leaving the door unlocked and whether or not it's foreseeable that someone comes into the home, takes an automobile, and later wrecks the vehicle, I would suggest is not foreseeable within the scope of foreseeability based on the legal duty analysis that I think the court would have to make. And I don't believe it's supported by the case law either. I just don't believe that authority is present.
Does she know her daughter's over there frequently or at least sometimes to swim?
No. In fact, Your Honor, the testimony in the transcript was that she had not done that ever in the past. So, no. There's no support for that position.
How did the daughter get into the swimming area?
Your Honor, I think, I don't know it's part of the settled record, but I think from a practical standpoint, we're talking about a home that is near a lake. So whether it's a fence situation or how she would have actually entered the home, I don't know that that's actually clear. The daughter's testimony, I can tell you, that is part of the settled record, is that she attempted or did enter the garage through a garage side garage door by putting her shoulder into it and breaking open the door. Whether or not she was able to access the lake or the pool from there, I guess I'm just not clear. Ultimately, our position is that not only are plaintiffs unable to establish a legal duty in this case regarding their vicarious liability claims, but also that 25, 5, 14, and 15 are entirely dispositive of the issues raised by State Auto, and that those statutes support the trial court's award of summary judgment in favor of Entreall. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Okay, Mr. Peterson, you have 10 minutes, sir.
I'd like to address a few points raised by opposing counsel during his argument. I'd like to start with the first point last on the issue of how did Dugan get into the house? Did she really put her shoulder into the garage door that has no sign of damage? Or did she go through the back patio door that was left unlocked by all earlier in the day? That's an issue for the jury. It's a classic fact question. The issue at this point is there a duty to lock that door? Obviously, there's not a duty to lock your own house to keep burglars from taking things and hurting other people. That's an entirely separate duty. But there ought to be a duty that if you are taking care of somebody's house, going there to water plants while someone's out of town, if they otherwise leave their house locked, when you leave the house, you should also leave it locked. And if you don't, and someone gets to the unlocked door, there should be at least a jury question as to whether there's liability. You know, if someone's in a rush and there's a reasonable reason why it wasn't locked, they may not have breached the duty, but that is something that the jury has to wrestle with in this case.
Wouldn't, under normal circumstances, the intervening cause here eliminate that duty anyway? If it weren't her daughter?
I believe there's a fine line that is walked between an intervening cause and a third party coming and interrupting the proximate causal chain. When you actually have at least an arguably negligent act that facilitates that theft, in that unique situation, the third party's actions do not relieve the negligent actor of liability. There are a number of cases cited in the appellant's brief. Probably the case that might be closest to on point is the Castro versus Kmart case. It's where keys were left open where anyone could get to them. A third party came in, stole the keys, took the vehicle, and damaged the vehicle. In that case, Kmart had a duty to the owner of the car not to have the keys out in the open. This case is not a lot different, and the relationship is not a lot different either. Audrey Ald was given the trust and access to the house, and she left it unlocked. That, at least under one version of the facts, that is how Dugan got into the house. In that case, there should be a duty.
On the other two duties, you know, I didn't see anything in your brief or submissions or statement of material facts that indicated what further control or supervision the mother should have exercised in this case.
Well, I believe the undisputed facts show that Adriel didn't do anything. She had no idea where her daughter was going to be that day. You know, if she can show that she did some things to further that duty, you know, there might be a case where there's no liability. But as the facts stand, she had no idea where her daughter was.
I thought she was supposed to be with a friend that day and evening.
She was with a friend, and the friend's mom brought Dugan and the friend to the closest place to swim. I believe the deposition from Adriel shows that she didn't know where her daughter was going to be that day. She didn't know if she was going to go out swimming at the closest home. Obviously didn't know she was going to steal a vehicle, but that type of knowledge isn't required for a duty to be imposed. Opposing counsel talks about Section 316 of the restatements and says there are two factors. One, the knowledge of the propensity to do a particular act and the ability to control. Actually, the restatement doesn't say that. It says specifically that the parent either has to know or have reason to know of an ability to control the child and have reason to know that the child should be controlled. The facts of this case show there was a prior pretty serious incident with alcohol before the age of 14. There was also facts in the record that Adriel drove with her daughter in the past, even though the daughter didn't have a driver's license. Those facts ought to give Adriel in this case some awareness that there's some risk out there and she should do some things to exercise control. And I think the facts of the case as they stand show that she didn't do anything to exercise that duty, which is it's obviously a breach of the duty without any effort to perform it. The facts in this case, taken in the light most favorable to State Auto, provides that there should be some duty to exercise control of the child.
support your argument of willful and malicious conduct on her part?
On the part of Dugan, I believe simply the theft of the vehicle is a willful and malicious act. Within that proximate causal chain, it's foreseeable that the property would be damaged. I think that is one thing. There's also another...
Well, the act of the accident itself purports to cover only negligence?
Yes, Your Honor. I think this is a classic case where there are at least two proximate causes on the part of Dugan. One is the negligent operation of the vehicle, and another is her intentional theft of the vehicle. The case law of the state is clear. There isn't only one proximate cause. There can be multiple proximate causes. And if the court looks to, I believe it's the Snyder versus Carpenter case, it talks about when there's negligent driving by a thief in the commission of a theft, that doesn't relieve the thief from being intentionally held liable for an intentional act related to the motor vehicle damage. The negligent act does not interrupt that proximate causal chain. It at most provides an additional proximate cause.
Well, you have to have both willful, which is like intentional, and malice in this case. The statute says both. And you know, what's malicious about taking your grandparents' car without their permission?
Well, I believe it's malicious because, number one, she has almost no experience driving. She has no license. She doesn't really know how to operate a motor vehicle. She knows she doesn't have permission. She takes the vehicle anyway. It's a theft of a vehicle. I believe that is enough to show malice.
Yeah, that might be correct for somebody of our age group, but this is a 14-year-old. Are they that well-educated at that stage? I mean, you throw a brick through somebody's picture window, that's clearly malice. But taking your grandparents' car when you're 14?
The statute doesn't differentiate actual malice from presumed malice. And when you get in other contexts, such as the punitive damages or even the bad faith context, actual malice is one form of malice, but presumed malice can be shown by essentially willful and wanton conduct. And I believe the use of malicious and willful is similar, and it's evolved into being willful and wanton conduct, which is essentially of a reckless nature. And in addition to the theft of the vehicle, Audrell was speeding, and she was doing so without the appropriate amount of experience to operate a motor vehicle. That's been sufficient to convict at least two defendants of manslaughter in the state under the Janklow and the Larson case. I think the facts of the case are similar. The states of mind requiring recklessness, willfulness, wantonness, presumed malice are very similar concepts, and I believe the facts of this case support a conclusion that there is malice and willfulness in this case. The last issue I'd like to touch on is application of the doctrine of the last antecedent. According to the statement of that rule in the recent case of Satellite Cable and also the slightly older case of Caberna, the only way that is not applied is when there is an obvious purpose in the statute. And I would submit there, when you read the statute, there isn't an obvious purpose that jumps out. If any purpose jumps out, it is to impose liability on parents, because without the statute, there would be no liability. And I believe that the legislature pulled motor vehicles out for a reason, and I believe that reason is they are a common implement of serious damages. And in this case, the property damage was serious. Fortunately, no one was personally injured, but this statute is a lot broader than this case and has broader policy implications.
I agree with you. It's to impose liability, but also the second sentence limits liability. So wouldn't the purpose also be limiting? And if you carried that to its next logical explanation, is that both clauses in that sentence would be limiting as opposed to extending?
Well, I would respectfully disagree with you, Your Honor. I believe the purpose of that second sentence is to frame what the amount of recovery is. That is the purpose, to define the contours of that. The first part of that, of the clause, states that the damages are $1,500. The second part also relates to the amount of recovery, and it states that there is no damage cap when you've got a motor vehicle-related accident. There's homeowner's coverage, and as between a tort victim and the parent of a child, the parent is clearly the most efficient risk bearer. They're in a much better position to try to exercise some control over their children. They're in a position to insure against that risk with homeowners. A tort victim is in a pretty tough position to do anything about property being stolen, about being run over with a car. I think those important policy decisions should guide this court to apply that statute and hold parents liable because they are in the best position to avoid the risk. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Court will be in recess until 11 o'clock.